Joint Committee of Ways and Means.
That's, what is the day then?
12th day of May, 2005. And here comes the chair. And so we'll just start. Unless, Steve, you want to start off with what you got?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to indicate that I've distributed two items to you this morning. One is in color, and that shows the co-chair suggestions relating to agency performance measures, which we hope to get some type of response from the agency today as to whether they believe that these changes are things that would be desirable and capable of implementing. The other item that I've distributed to you is a repeat of the list of how you prioritize the programs at the end of phase one for this agency. And again, the agency will be commenting on this prioritization, on how you prioritize their programs. I do have one other item which I have not distributed to you yet, which I will start distributing to you when you begin your testimony. And for this, I apologize to the committee and to the Department of Community Colleges, because this is a response that they've made to a number of questions that Senator Devlin gave them. And they actually responded a couple weeks ago, and I failed to distribute that until now. So I apologize if this delay has caused you any problems, but I will be distributing these responses to you as well. This, of course, does not. This document is not related to the agency before you today.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Shall the agency start?
Yeah.
good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Margie Lau. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. We're going to pick up this morning on the slide that was in your materials yesterday that's labeled cost containment. It follows after a page that said something about the shared responsibility model that okay. This is going to be per the script that we were asked to do per the co-chairs for this part of the phase two presentation. Cost containment has been a very strong initiative at the Student Assistance Commission for the entire biennium. As the committee is well aware, we were going through a very serious financial challenge at the agency related to the loan program. And so from the very start, the agency was engaged in a lot of efforts to minimize costs. But as the biennium progressed and it became clear that certain things were going to have to happen, the natures of those cost containments moved from reduced travel, reduced cupping, reduced services and supplies types of things to much broader initiatives. We were under a federal audit that had said that the agency, from the federal perspective, owed to the federal government $6 million funding related to the loan program and some issues that were there. In how we were able to close out the loan program, which we are hopefully just days away from signing the final papers for, we've been able to leave that with just simply returning to, with the loan program as it goes to the Education Credit Management Corporation, the funds that were in the loan program balances in both the operating fund and the federal fund, which is what is used to repurchase loans, that is satisfying that remaining obligation. And so we're basically leaving that with a zero sum owed. which we consider to be quite a success. There were some modest costs that we had to shift, and that was a decision that was made by the emergency board in January in order to shift some of the costs that needed to still remain over to general fund for the remaining 6 months of the biennium as the loan program left the state's jurisdiction. We worked very hard to outplace the loan program employees and other affected employees that were in the administrative area that were also being downsized. In doing this, at this point, we're only paying unemployment insurance costs for 6 out of the 61 reduced positions. We vacated over half of the space that the agency had occupied. With that came the need to sort out a whole bunch of equipment in order to reduce costs there. If we would have gone to state surplus equipment in their sales process, we would have had to pay transportation costs for all that stuff to come to Salem. Instead, we donated it to nonprofits and schools in the Eugene area if they would come and pick it up, which they did. We salvaged all of the supplies that we could so that we minimized costs in the 05-07 biennium. We've become quite a group of scroungers. We also reduced permanent and seasonal staff wherever we could. And I'll talk more about the seasonal staff side of this when we go over to the program efficiency slide, which is next. So a number of different things, quite above and beyond what you normally see in an agency in terms of just routine cost-saving types of endeavors. But it was a rather extraordinary biennium, so hopefully we won't have to do anything like that again in anywhere in the near future. When it comes to improved program delivery, as we were focusing on moving the loan program to the private sector, we were also focusing on how to improve our program delivery for the remaining programs. And the one that creates the most significant savings for the state general fund is the rule change that the commission adopted last month, which introduces an asset test for the opportunity grant. This asset test first ties the initial decision on eligibility for the opportunity grant to the federal Pell eligibility criteria. And this criteria generally says that families need to have an expected family contribution of around $3,800 or less in order to get Pell funding. We felt that there were sometimes circumstances that created an exigency in a family that was too narrow a definition, so our rule change allows families with an expected family contribution of up to $5,000 where the student can still demonstrate a remaining need based on whatever they're getting from other financial assistance, that they can come back and ask for reconsideration, and on an exception basis, we can allow that student also to still get the opportunity grant. We expanded the Expire program with a really great grant that we received from the Federal AmeriCorps program. This funds members from AmeriCorps in 39 different schools where they can really provide the resources for the school to go out and recruit the volunteers and to get the legwork set up so that they can be a fully functioning school in a much quicker basis to be able to aid students in preparing for post-secondary education.
Excuse me. Yes. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Currently, we're not putting any general fund dollars into Aspire. Would there be an opportunity to get more either federal funds or other grant funds if the state put in, if we found some savings in other parts of your budget and put some into the Aspire program?
Mr. Chair, Representative March, the Aspire program, we would love to have it so that it could serve every high school in the state. We see certainly a need for that. I don't know that it's the lack of general fund that is the limit. I hear that in certain programs they look for matching funds to be provided. And in fact, there is some general fund that supports because Aspire is paying for its own direct operations but is not paying any or a very small proportion of any of the indirect support. So We've just received a new grant from Ford that's allowing us to add a half a regional FTE. But one of the things that we hear is that from both Ford and the Community Foundation is that they would like their money to be seed money, and that that would not be there permanently. And we're really having to rely on those two foundations to really sustain the program as it is right now. And they are very great partners, but you know, they get a little anxious when we continue to rely on them solely for keeping the program functional.
Thank you.
In the scholarship area, we have really made some wonderful efficiencies, and I can really attest to this from the other side of that computer screen when you've got a high school student trying to fill out an application and having done a lot of different forms. The OSAC one is by far and away the gold standard for scholarship applications. Not only is it a single electronic application for 320 different scholarships, but it's a very well-run website that you can use to operate, because I've done lots of different forms for different scholarships, and most of them are not very user-friendly, but the OSAC one absolutely is. By going online, over two-thirds of our applications this year came in electronically. This has really saved us a tremendous amount of staff time in having to enter those student applications. In the past, all of those had to be entered by data entry staff prior to our being able to then send the applications out to all of the different donor organizations for a selection process. In order to advance that selection process in a more speedy fashion, we also have a process that this year encouraged students to apply early. And of course, as parents, we always encourage our children to not wait until the last minute, but pressures being what they are, a lot of times they are last minute. But this time we hope most families viewed last minute as being February 15th, because we had 16 early bird scholarships that we offered for students who filed all the applications correctly by that date. If they did that, they went into a random drawing, and donors provided 16 $500 scholarships that students could then be selected for based on that early submission. About a third of our applications did come in by that February 15 date, which helps our donor organizations and certainly helps us reduce costs and increase turnaround time. We also have increased our scholarship capacity. We have made efforts to streamline how we work with donors and how we also work with our internal processing to handle this. Our biggest limitation in this area presently is a rather primitive data processing system that we have. It's really three different systems, part access database, part accounting system, and part mainframe system on an AS400. Reconciling the dollars that are going out to all the various entities becomes somewhat labor-intensive and confusing sometimes. And we're hoping to raise donor support to be able to do an integrated system in this next biennium. If we can increase that efficiency, then it will expand our ability to handle an even greater number of donor scholarships in the coming biennium. We also have a partnership with the Oregon Community Foundation for the investment of our funds. We have OCF has a great deal of expertise around maximizing the return on donor contributions, and also they have a lot of expertise on how to encourage donors' generosity, both in number and in quantity, in terms of the dollars offered. So we partner with them using our expertise in administration of the scholarships, and OCF, the Community Foundation, offers us their expertise around maximizing the return and also the encouragement and work with families and other entities that want to share their generosity in helping students go to school. And in the Office of Degree Authorization, we have done a number of things in order to increase public awareness about the diploma mill challenge that we have all across the globe, actually, but in our country and state as well. We have a website that allows people 24 hours a day to be able to go and see, you know, is this place that's offering me this, what sounds like too good to be true, opportunity to advance my education, what's their credibility? That's available to people to go and look at on the website. And in addition to that, in order to help legitimate programs get off the ground quickly, we've moved so that we've added priority to new programs wanting to be approved for offering diplomas, that we've expedited the process for that so those new programs can be up and running sooner in a way that's going to meet the needs of their students and their investors. In professional services and purchasing, we used to do a lot of this in the loan program, but those days are in the past. So our biggest thing in terms now in professional services around the loan program is that we went through a process that was deemed by DAS and the Department of Justice to be basically a contracting out process. So that was our biggest effort around purchasing activity and the exit from the loan program. But for the future, our efforts really are around our arrangements and contract with the Oregon Community Foundation for donor agreement and investing decisions. I think the major budgetary issues for OSAC were well covered in Steve and Bill's presentation yesterday. Just to refresh the committee's memory about some of the issues that were talked about, we have the modifications to the Opportunity Grant Program related to the federal funds, the fact that we won't have the monies for that for 1 year, very probably in the next biennium, and then also the savings from the asset rule in the Opportunity Grant. That particular rule change saves us about $740,000. We have some workload charts for you to be able to look at so you can see generally what the level of awarding is in the scholarship programs. The applications seem to have somewhat plateaued in terms of what's coming to us from high school students and from adult learners. But the dollars awarded has somewhat leveled out at about $12 million. We have dollars awarded here reflecting still the Ford family contributions on an annual basis, because although we do not do the actual payment part of that transaction, we are doing the lion's share, the front-end work in the application screening and review process. You can see the total number of awards, that is actually up as well. For the Aspire schools, another one of our programs where we're looking to the level of participation. In the next school year, we've just made the decisions and announcements about which schools will be Aspire schools. We will be up to 74 high schools being served across the state. In the opportunity grant area, again, I think the committee's heard a great deal about this particular program and its growth. We're hoping that the numbers that we'll be able to serve in the future will be, Bill loaned me his little laser pointer here, so hopefully I can be coordinated here, that we'll be able to serve the total number of students who are eligible at the 55% median family income level. This is the number that represents full-time students in the future. In addition to that, we hope to be able to serve the part-time student population as well. As the committee can see, there's a fair amount written about what proportion of the eligible population we serve. Depends upon how we define eligible, and one of the questions that was posed in the co-chair's instructions for Phase 2 was to talk about the history back to before we had all of the state's economic difficulties. If we would have been able to stay at where we were at prior to the onset of the recession, we would have still been at the 75% of median family income level, which would have been this more purplish colored bar here, which would have had us serving 69,000 students, or 59,000 students in a year, instead of the what is at the 55% median family income level, which is at about 49,000 students. The number that are actually getting grants in the current year is this $18,000 figure here. So that's where the numbers come in about us serving only 30% roughly of the eligible population. That's hearkening back to this number prior to the recession about how many students would have been eligible.
Yes.
If I may, Mr. Chair and members, you've heard that the currently 70% of the eligible students are able to get awards, or at least are getting awarded awards this biennium, and that 30% are not getting the award, and that both the governor's budget and the co-chair's budgets contain funding to provide awards for that remaining 30%. In the governor's budget for both years of the upcoming biennium, and in the case of the co-chair's budgets, only for the beginning the second year of the upcoming biennium. I did, though, want to point out, if you look at that diagram that Ms. Lowe has on the board, you'll see that for 2004-05, there's roughly 18,000, 19,000 awards, which is far less than 70% of either the $49,000 number to the left of that bar or the $59,000 person bar to the right of it. But what is actually happening, the reason why we say that 70% are being receiving the award, even though it doesn't look like it from that chart, is that of the roughly 48, 49,000 that apply, approximately 70% are offered the award, but the numbers who actually receive the award is the 18, 19,000 level, because there are a substantial number of people who are awarded the opportunity grant but then do not actually receive it because they then do not meet the enrollment requirements.
So this may be students who choose to go to school out of state, or choose not to go to school, or who are not able to go to school full time. If they're not able to register for at least 12 credit hours in a term, they're not eligible. So
I think Mr. Bender provided some clarification, but he actually provided an additional question, too. When we talk about both the governors and the co-chairs in the second year going to covering 100% of those eligible, are we talking about 100% of those that are at 55%?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. We're talking about 100% of the 55%.
So no one is talking about returning to the previous 75% level?
Mr. Chair, not at this point. That's one of those things that people hope to be able to study to say, and I think that's where we're looking at taking more of a slope approach, so that those who have a little bit better income situation perhaps would have a reduced grant amount. And so those are items for future exploration.
Okay. Thank you.
Did Representative Jensen have a question? Or?
Oh, I'm just running through Mr. Bender's comments and your charts here and trying to do some rough approximation of the ratio. In arriving at this 70% that we're going to, and it sounds like we're, on the surface, it sounds like we're giving awards to 70%. We're offering awards to 70%. But
correct.
Not all 70% take the awards. Therefore, is there a cash carryover here? Do we have some money that is unexpended that could have been spent?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, the Student Assistance Commission's Opportunity Grant Program operates a bit like an airline reservation service, where we're using past history to guess what kind of actual booking versus folks who show up at the gate wanting a seat in the plane rate's going to be. And so we're assuming a certain pickup rate is the term that we use as we do the funding estimates for
this.
So
we're not actually operating at 70%. We're operating at 70 less X percent because some people don't show up, and that's all factored in as far as the dollars are concerned.
Mr. Chair, Representative.
What is the X percent? I guess Mr. Bender looked like he might have been running some numbers.
I am trying to. If you have a comment on that, why don't you go ahead, because I'm just trying to calculate this by hand here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, I don't have that number right off the top.
It's really okay. I'm just trying to get the, trying to get the picture of, So when we talk about funding at 100%, we're really not going to put out 100%. You know, we've got some slush fund or some variable there that, using your airline illustration, is a good illustration, and I'll accept that.
My rough calculations here show that only about a little over half, about 55% or so, of the people who receive notification that they're eligible for an opportunity grant actually get one.
Get one. Okay. Mr. Chair? For a variety of reasons, whatever they happen to be. They don't show up. They don't meet the qualifications. They drop down to part-time, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay. Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is pronounced Lohr, right? It's Lortel, correct?
Wow.
How do you handle, does a student have to be admitted before they get the scholarship? And how do you balance the public school versus the private school? I mean, you have a running checking account, and that person comes in and says, I've been accepted in both. And you say, well, I only have money to give you the state school versus the private school. I mean, that seems, and do you have any management principles or policies that you implement within the association that you say, we're only, because if you use all the private, if everyone went to private, we're going to be servicing a lot fewer students. So is there a policy as far as how many public versus private grants we're giving, and how does that fit in acceptance versus when you get the grant?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, it's all built into the model. And as you'll recall from our presentation in Phase 1, we have different cutoff dates where we do not yet know that a student's been admitted to a particular college. The decision about whether a student is opportunity grant eligible based on the finances is actually made within days after they file their FAFSA, the Free Application for Federal Student Aid form. And we're looking at, do they meet our rules in terms of their financial eligibility? We're making a guess that what they list as their first Oregon school is their first priority school on that FAFSA form. Sometimes students make other choices for a wide variety of reasons. And for those of you who've worked in post-secondary education, you know that a lot of students are doing a lot of campus visits through the winter and the spring terms, trying to decide which school is going to be the best fit for them and their families' finances as well. So we're saying you are eligible or you're not eligible as soon as we're seeing that FAFSA information based on their school. If they say they're going to go to an independent college, that school system generally has earliest cutoff dates, because the past legislative and commission policy has been that we will only fund up to X percentage of the funds to each of those different sectors. It's a very careful balance that we have between all three sectors. The latest cutoff dates are for the community colleges. Their cutoff dates tend to be late July or August, but that better meets what the application process is for many community college students, because many of them don't apply until the summertime, make the decision to go to school. So those cutoff dates determine when things will happen in terms of, do they meet eligibility? But a student may have listed that they were going to go to a community, to an independent college, but later decide that they're going to a community college. If they file their FAFSA prior to the cutoff date for the community colleges, even though they may not have gotten award notice from the independent college that they applied to because they may have applied too late, they will ultimately be awarded an opportunity grant at the community college because that cutoff date happens much later in the process. But if a student decided to go to an independent college in June or July, then they would probably be too late if they had only at that point filed the FAFSA. But they would certainly be too late if that's when they filed the FAFSA. If they filed the FAFSA in January, then that's still going to be possible if they meet the financial criteria. Did that answer the question?
Very good. Mr. Chair, one little follow-up. So
yes.
And I apologize if you've given us this in phase one, but what is
it's
it?
Been a while.
20%, 30% go to non-state schools or versus, you know, private schools, not community colleges? Or
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wisant, I think I don't know the numbers right off the top in terms of student percentages. Is that so? It's a balance in terms of the same proportion between each of the three different sectors. So trying to not have a particular bias for one sector versus another.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please proceed.
If you have any other questions about this chart, we'll move on to the next one, which talks about our fee and revenue changes. There are a number of uncertainties around federal funds, and we go into more detail on these on the next chart. The thing that we know right now that's at most jeopardy is the leveraging educational assistance and the special leveraging educational assistance partnership programs funds. Yesterday in one of the committees I sat in on, the question came up about what is maintenance of effort. This is a program where the federal government has encouraged states to offer NEED grant programs to their students. In this program, they offer these funds to states if we can show that we've maintained our prior levels of efforts. We lost these two federal funds during one of the years of the special sessions and recessions because we weren't able to maintain the prior level of effort. These funds, unfortunately, the federal government doesn't have the same maintenance of effort requirement. If we maintain our effort, they can still decide not to, and it seems a bit one-sided, that partnership. These funds are also used in part as maintenance of effort funds for the State Department of Human Services in pulling down the temporary assistance to needy families dollars. Since this program serves high-need families, it also is eligible to be treated as maintenance of effort for that DHS program as well. The programs that are also at jeopardy right now in much of the federal debate that's going on is the Robert Byrd Scholarship Program. This is a scholarship that goes to very high-achieving students. 15 students for each congressional district receive this award each year. And it's about $450,000 of scholarship funds that are at risk in that program. Also, the GEAR UP program, a program that we do jointly with schools across the state and with the University of Oregon, has also on some chopping blocks in some of the federal proposals. This chart actually gives you more detail. I won't go into all of the detail on these particular federal fund changes. None of these require any state legislative changes. On the other fund side of things, there are a number of different programs that are also having some modifications. During the current biennium, we increased our administrative charges for our scholarship donor programs from 10% to 12%. This is a charge that we do against the dollars that are awarded to students. It's not based on the dollars that are invested, but rather the dollars that are awarded. We have just gotten a confirmation that the Ford Family Foundation is going to grant us 3 years of funding for the rural community participation folks who work in the Aspire program. So that's a stable funding source for us for a while to come on the Aspire program. We also have entered into an agreement with Southern Oregon University where they ask us to administer their institution scholarships as well. So their students, when they fill out the single scholarship application for OSAC, are also doing the scholarship application for all of the Southern Oregon University scholarships. And there's a small administrative charge that they pay for our handling that front end of the work for their institution. As Mr. McGee mentioned yesterday, the Oregon Financial Aid Exchange database, this is a program that was created three or four years ago as a marketing tool for the student loan program. When students dual enroll at more than one institution, and this is becoming more and more common, particularly between our community colleges and our four-year public universities in Oregon, the coordination of the financial aid benefits is a very important task that needs to be done between those institutions because there are all kinds of issues that have to be dealt with if the student is offered too much financial aid, but there's also considerable barriers the student might experience if they don't receive all of the financial aid for which they're eligible. In order for these schools to make sure they deliver just the right amount of financial aid to the student based on their eligibility, they've got to know what the cost of attendance is at both institutions, as well as what the overall credit load is that the student has enrolled for. So the OFAX system actually is a database where we match those two institutions' common populations so they can see the like information for their counterpart institution for the same student body. This is going to be a very important asset as the Oregon Health Sciences University moves to an articulated nursing program with a number of institutions across the state where students who are in nursing programs in many of our community colleges will also be dual enrolled at OHSU at the same time. Because the loan program no longer exists as a part of the Student Assistance Commission, the underlying funding that was coming from the loan program revenues won't be there to support that. And so the governor's budget proposes that this be based on a small fee that we charge to each of the participating schools. The Jobs Plus program is a program that we talked about in phase one. This program is one where the Student Assistance Commission receives the interest earnings off of the funds that are sitting in the individual education accounts waiting for the student to utilize those funds. And this program, during the coming biennium, is likely to go through a substantial change because there's legislation that has to be passed in order to extend the employment department's participation in the program. If that does not happen, about two-thirds of the future participants probably will not be in the program any longer because that's about the amount of the potential individual education account recipients. That's the portal that they use for entering the program.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I wish Senator Wissett was here because he gave me a paper and he's concerned about this. What is the legislation number? And, you know, this was a good program that's helping our people losing jobs in the timber industry and things like that. Why I'm hearing what you're saying is we're going to discontinue it and we've got $2.6 million going to sit there and DHS is going to keep it. I don't understand. Do you think it's a good program? And would people not come in and keep up their accounts or use the accounts? Or what was the problem with it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wissett, the bill that would extend the Employment Department portion of the program is House Bill 3462. And I've got a number of questions that we've prepared responses to as a part of the latter part of my presentation, where I'd be glad to cover that in more depth. So we do think it's a good program, and we are looking at ways in which to increase the utilization for those folks who have accounts currently standing. To move on to the budget detail for the program, as Mr. McGee said yesterday, and this is one where I think it's very hard to track these numbers up on this slide, and so I would encourage folks to actually use the spreadsheets that are in your presentation document. As Mr. McGee discussed yesterday, there have been a lot of changes at the Student Assistance Commission, and at the point in which we were preparing the numbers that Mr. McGee needed to use to put this budget together last November, we were in the midst of the dissolution of the student loan program, and we did not really have a very good way in which to gauge what the ongoing costs were going to be for the remaining part of the program. So the numbers that we provided to Mr. McGee were preliminary, and he and I both viewed those to be rather a placeholder, that we're certainly going to need a fair amount of refinement as we moved into the legislative session. And so once the issues and the urgency of the loan program faded, we put a lot of attention into work with the remaining managers to identify what are the things that we need and what has been the past history for what the costs for those portions of our program have been, and to really refine these numbers considerably.
Ms. Lowe, since it's been a while since Phase 1, can you remind the committee of when you became the director of the agency?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Devlin, I stepped into that position January 1st. I was working on a half-time basis of this year, yes. I was working on a half-time basis starting early September to help the agency deal with the issues of the loan program decisions while I was still working as an administrator at the Department of Human Services. So I was working half of the week in Salem and half of the week in Eugene. So it's been a very rapid learning curve that I've jumped into.
I'd say you've done very well as well.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
Again, as we were rapidly immersing ourselves and trying to understand what the best direction was going to be for the future, there was also a lot of turnover in the upper management of the agency. The agency lost its chief financial officer, the chief operating officer, the agency director had stepped down, and so there was a loss of history and continuity about how certain things had gone into how the agency request budget had been built. So as we move forward, I work very actively with the remaining managers, the ongoing managers, Mr. Contreras with Office of Degree Approval, and Ms. Merkel from the Grants and Scholarships Program, and with also the accounting staff to look closely at all of the remaining numbers. So the numbers that you see first on the administrative budget for the governor's recommended budget is kind of a milepost on the way to what we really needed to have. So if you want to turn on to the next page, the agency's revised budget, this is what we think is a much truer picture of what we'll need to have. One of the things that we found is that these, and the slide doesn't show it here, but you see it at the top of your sheet. This first column is the beginning balance. And the beginning balance numbers that had been in the agency request didn't seem to bear a lot of resemblance to reality. So those numbers had to be modified considerably, particularly in the Aspire program. We do not know where in the agency request budget the $1.5 million beginning balance had come from. There's not, unfortunately, certainly in Representative March's view, not that sort of seed money there to start the new biennium with. The Aspire program is, it lives by what it brings in its grant activities. So it really does not start with a beginning balance. We have a beginning balance in the grants and scholarships section and in the Office of Degree Authorization, but those beginning balances are quite modest. Then we add to that the general fund appropriation and the other revenues that we expect to bring in the grants and scholarships, Aspire program, and in the Office of Degree Authorization. Part of the revenues that we bring in the grants and scholarships is shifted to information services because information services certainly exist mostly to support the functions of the grants and scholarships program.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I think we have to ask Mr. McGee where these governor's ending balances came from. I mean,
Mr. Chair, Senator Wissett, Bill McGee from Department of Administrative Services. The ending balances was a reflection of the inaccuracies in the beginning balances, basically, and we knew those were incorrect. We knew that we would be making some significant changes, both the budget and the revenue estimates, before we came to you today. So, Ms. Lessig, we did have very much in the way of placeholder numbers in the governor's budget. There was a good deal of lack of information historically, and it took us pretty much a lot of time through the spring to get to what we think are reasonable numbers. I'll say the ending balance that we're proceeding with is worrisome. It is lower than we would want to deal with cash flow and compensation issues. It's something we will be looking at carefully during the course of the interim. The agency hopes, as Ms. Law said yesterday, to be able to increase their scholarship funds, and that there may be some opportunities to generate some additional cushion there. But it is a concern for us as we move forward. And there is some possibility you could see us at the emergency board if things break in ways we wouldn't expect them to. Equipment failures, legal costs, other things that could come forward.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
My wife and I would have a long discussion if my check balance went from $1.6 million to $89 million. I don't understand still where we're...
Ms. Chair, Representative Wisnett, without going a great deal into kind of a discussion of history that I don't think really needs to be on the record at this point, there were inaccurate numbers that we went through. Ms. Lau indicated the turnover in the staff. We knew there were...
Mr. Chair, follow up, please.
Yeah.
I think it should be on the record. Are we talking about management oversight? Are we talking about DHS oversight? Who are we talking about that went from... We lost $1.6 million in the checking account.
I think we never had it, Representative Wisnett. I think it was management inexperience at a previous period in time. I guess I'd leave it at that at this point. We have improved the quality of the management. We've looked carefully. We spent a great deal of time in this interim attempting to try and resolve these issues. And I think we're in a better situation to move forward as far as information goes, even if we are not where we would want to be in terms of cash reserves.
Is the chair comfortable with that?
Well, the one thing the chair finds interesting is that even in the previous documents, they were attributable to the Aspire program, the beginning fund balance. Did that have anything to do with the error in terms of how they were accounting for the funds?
Mr. Chair, the initial balance that was shown there, I think, was related to aspirations in the Aspire program about how they might have been able to generate even greater grant donor dollars, and that didn't get corrected. And so what you have before you is what we see as being likely, given our past experience, not our future aspirations. As those future aspirations become reality, we will come back to you at the emergency board and ask for permission to increase our limitation as we collect and are more successful with our donor relationships and also with some of our other programs. For example, the Chaffee Foster Youth Scholarship Program that we offer. In that program, because it's a year-round program, we actually receive 17% as our administrative charge in our agreement with the Department of Human Services in our mutual administration of the program. The more successful those Chaffee foster youth are in going to college and staying in college, the more successful they are as individuals, but also the more successful OSAC is, because in that area, if we can help those students stay in school, we can help DHS draw down a greater share of those funds, and 17% of that then helps pay for the agency operations. So I think it's a very healthy relationship. If we make students more successful, and in doing that, we are also more successful.
Yes, Senator Nelson.
I mean, basically what you're saying, there was mismanagement back there someplace, and you guys are being nice and don't want to say that particularly, but there was some errors in judgment. Was the money ever there?
No, there's no lost money, Senator. The money wasn't there. It was, I think, an experience on some individuals' part and enthusiasm in terms of what they hoped would be. Things we would not usually record in the system until they actually came through were recorded.
Spent the money that was $54
million. Well, we never really got the expenditure limitation to go with those dollars. We sort of had a feeling that they weren't accurate, and so even when the governor's budget was put together, we didn't assume that we were going to spend anything in those, but we knew we'd come back to you with some corrections and
they're dropping to
take care of it.
Representative March?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and my question had to do with, I think, it seems to me that part of this could have been tied to some of the shift from when you were operating with a 90 plus or minus number of staff to what your current staff level is, and running a loan program that you're winding yourself out of. I mean, it's pretty hard to predict what those ending balances and those other funds and et cetera are gonna be. And of course, you're new to it, so. But it seems, you know, the organization has gone through a tremendous shift in the last. In this last biennium, and I assume that that's part of the issue.
Mr. Chair, Representative March, that's very accurate. The agency, because of the very high level of risk in the loan program and the urgency of dealing with that risk, put the lion's share of its financial resources in terms of personnel into really tracking and trying to deal with that. And it was truly on a week-to-week basis as to whether we were going to have sufficient funds to repurchase loans that we were under federal obligation to do, and also resources to pay payroll. And so there was a lot of energy, the limited resources that the agency had, focused on just managing that highest risk category. Once that portion of the ledger became dormant, it allowed us to focus more energies on these other places and go, oh, well, what's happening here? And so we have doubled up our efforts there in order to put that back on a more even keel.
Thank you.
The agency's made reductions in its projected expenditures in virtually every category. If you turn on to the last page here in the
screen. Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Hold up on this just a second. Can you tell me all the things that are in personal services category?
Let's see if I can go to the previous here. In personal services, this pays for basically the 23 remaining staff in the agency plus some temporary staff and a small amount of overtime. We have a very heavy peak season that runs from the end of February through May as we deal with the whole scholarship allocation decision-making process. So during that peak workload season, we bring on three or four temporary employees, and other employees are working overtime during that time period.
Mr. Chair, I was thinking that's what it is, but this is somewhere in the neighborhood of $160,000 per FTE. This is pretty well paid department.
Per
That's probably correct. I did want to comment on, please be aware that for each, this represents 2 years of salary plus benefit costs.
Okay, I always get confused on that. There.
If we can go on to the table which shows the differences, this will help you understand where we have realized the savings across the agency. And again, this is looking at just the administrative budget. We've not made reductions in the dollars that are there in grant and aid, the dollars actually helping students go to school. But in personal services, we have $202,000 of general fund savings, $127,000 in other fund savings. In services and supplies, we have overall $732,000 in savings. For a total savings in general fund, $765,000, and total fund savings of over $1 million. Now, part of that $1 million is, and the lion's share of the other fund saving is because that's reflecting more accurately the real revenues that we're going to have. There were three positions that, because we didn't yet have a clear picture on the revenues at the point in which we were providing information to Mr. McGee for the governor's recommended budget. There's actually resources in the governor's budget for three positions that there's not adequate revenue for. And so we are proposing that you eliminate those three positions that were other funds financed along with the limitation that goes with those positions. I think the staff at the Student Assistance Commission really that are remaining should be commended. This has been a very strong team effort on the part of all of the folks that I've had an honor to work with for the last 4 months. And folks there are very realistic and pragmatic individuals. And they are very dedicated people to the mission of the agency. It's a pleasure to work there. To move on to the legislation in the agencies, the bills that are related to the Student Assistance Commission that are out there, we've grouped those into three categories. And for I'll cover the first two, and in addition to that, I'll let Alan Contreras cover those that are related to the Office of Degree Authorization. One of the things that we found as we were going through the staff reduction process and also the work with DAS labor relations staff is that the employees at the Student Assistance Commission presently do not have background checks done in terms of their criminal records. These are folks who are working a lot with students and minors. Many times they're in high schools and in other public forums with young people. And unfortunately, we've had some difficulties with some of our past employees related to criminal histories that would be very troubling to our school partners and our partners at DHS. Because of this, we are asking that House Bill 2157 be amended to add in the Student Assistance Commission as one of those agencies that would have the right to use fingerprinting as a part of the background check process. Student Assistance Commission also is glad that Representative March has proposed legislation that has to do with the continuation of the Aspire program. We do not require legislation to operate this program, but it's one that is kind of an affirmation of something that we are already doing. As I already mentioned, the Jobs Plus program for the Employment Department portion of that program is tied up in House Bill 3462. If that bill is not passed, then the part of the program that we would continue to operate is our partnership with DHS, Children, Adults, and Families, for the public assistance participants. In the grants and scholarships area, there are a number of different scholarships that have been proposed by various members of the legislature. These include one that would expand the occupations covered under the Rural Health Services Program to include pharmacists. It does not actually add funds, but would allow pharmacists to be one of the occupations. Senate Bill 637 would create a new scholarship that would encourage multicultural students to become teachers. This is a loan forgiveness program that would operate, I think, somewhat parallel to the health occupations programs that we have. The agency itself has proposed House Bill 2079, which would eliminate a duplicate scholarship program for dependents of deceased and disabled public safety officers. Oregon already offers such a scholarship program through the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. That's a long acronym I have a hard time remembering. And also the federal Department of Justice also offers one. Unfortunately, this bill has not yet had a hearing. And so at this point, these students still remain eligible for a very large grants that as a part of the Opportunity Grant Program. So these are funds that come basically off the top of the Opportunity Grant funds that OSAC administers. House Bill 2554 would transfer the Student Child Care Program from DHS to the Student Assistance Commission July 1st of 2006. Both we and the Department of Human Services support this legislation. It's presently in the possession of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. And the Mr. last
Chair,
one
mm-hmm. is who's pushing that bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Withant, that is supported by the Oregon Student Association. It has no fiscal impact in that it just transfers the dollars that are presently at the Department of Human Services to the Student Assistance Commission mid-biennium. That it allows us to better connect.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Is ODE supporting that or opposing that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wizard, it's not the Oregon Department of Education. It's instead the Department of Human Services. And DHS, yes, does support the bill.
I'll talk, Mr. Chair, follow up, please.
Yeah.
I'd like to talk to you about that offline. I brought that up in this committee several times, the ODE, about this program, and I thought they were in charge of it. I didn't know DHS was in charge of it, and because they said they are monitoring the program, unsuccessfully, but they're monitoring. I don't oppose it. That's something I'd like to see us do a better job as a state than we're doing with this program, because we haven't had any successes, I understand, in implementing that program. So I would appreciate maybe we talk offline.
Sure, I would be glad to.
And I would not oppose this move, but and I hope that we'll get some attention and interest and success that it has not received in ODE or DHS or wherever it is. I've never been told it was under DHS. And a year and a half in education committees.
I think, Representative Wiseman, one of the discussions has been is that due to the nature of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission and the type of work that it does and its actual clientele, that it would probably be a better fit with them than with DHS. Because they're actually different demographics. And
yes.
Completely concur, Mr. Chair, and be glad to try to move the bill or whatever.
And I think the other reason was every time there's a request for a cut list, DHS offers up programs it doesn't really have a lot of connection to, and that happens to be one of them. So to put it in with a group that it's more a better fit seems appropriate.
Yeah.
The last bill that is actively moving in the legislature related to scholarships or student assistance is a bill that's presently called the Oregon Troops to Teachers Program. This is a bill that was heard yesterday in the House Education Committee, and I think it received a subsequent referral to the House Budget Committee. And this one would be a program that would create another loan forgiveness program that would encourage or provide financial assistance to people coming off of current commitments with the National Guard or the military to become teachers. So this would pay their cost of gaining their teacher certification, and then they would serve in either a high poverty area or teach math, science, or special education in order to earn the forgiveness side of this program. So with that, you guys turn over to Mr. Contreras to speak to the Office of Degree Authorization.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Alan Contreras, Administrator of the Office of Degree Authorization. It looks like there's four bills here, but in substantive terms, there are only three. Senate Bill 1039 at the top is the same thing as House Bill 2182. What this does, you may remember last year there was a suit filed by a Wyoming entity called Kennedy Western University against the state of Oregon, raising constitutional issues about how we handle degrees issued by unaccredited schools. One of the requirements of the settlement of that case, which did not go to trial, is that we introduce legislation to resolve that constitutional issue by making a revision in the statute. That is what Senate Bill 1039 and House Bill 2182 are for. Senate Bill 1039 passed the Senate, I think, about a week ago. My understanding is that that is the bill that is going forward at this time. House Bill 2150 was sort of our catch-all bill to deal with several different relatively minor housekeeping and minor substantive issues. You may recall that last session, the Ways and Means Committee, for those of you who were on it, that told us to charge fees for all of our degree validation activities and so on. But one of the things that was not in there was the ability to charge fees to the parties in adverse impact cases if we are doing all the mediation and stuff like that. So that is something that we had asked for in House Bill 2150. In addition, it includes a provision having to do with notice for hearings of civil penalties. That is currently in the commission rule. The commission felt that might be better in statute. There's also a couple of other things in there having to do with the evaluation of foreign degrees and so on. That bill, as far as I can tell, is still in the House Education Committee, but has not yet had a hearing. House Bill 2151 was originally introduced to try to solve a problem that was brought to our attention by the Department of Justice a couple of years ago, which has to do with the way that the state authorizes different kinds of religious institutions to issue college degrees. Historically, there have been two very different kinds of such institutions, the standard ones like Multnomah Bible and Eugene Bible that went through the regular process, and the generally much smaller ones, which were called religious exempt schools, because they had chosen to go through an exemption procedure under which the degrees they issue would only be legal for use in religious occupations. These are essentially small church-based schools that train their own ministers, and they want to be able to issue a college-level degree to do that. The mechanism through which that is done has problems, according to the Department of Justice. And House Bill 2151 was our original vehicle to try to fix those. However, in the last few weeks, there have been a series of meetings between our office, the Department of Justice, Portland Bible College, and their attorneys to try to work up some language to deal with this issue that is somewhat different than what's in 2151. The current plan, as I understand it, is if we are able to come up with such language, it will be proposed as an amendment to Senate Bill 1039 when that comes up in House Education, because it has a very broad relating clause, including anything relating to college degrees. I know some of that's kind of complicated, so if any of you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Please proceed.
That concludes the ODA portion of the legislative bill presentation.
Thank you.
At this point, I'd like to move on to the performance measures update portion of our presentation. One of the things that the committee had asked in phase one, if you recall, we at that point presented very early information that we had just garnered having to do with the persistence rates of students who, comparing NEED grant recipients, opportunity grant recipients, with their counterparts, those students who were just a little bit too late and were not able to receive the NEED grant. And the committee had a concern that, given the information that we presented was from a 1998-99 school year, that was this information really reflective of what we're still experiencing today? So we ran this information against our database in order to see what our experiences were over a number of years. So what you have here are basically individual year cohorts represented by a pair of lines. The upper line reflects the subsequent FAFSA filings by students who received the grant, and the lower line reflects the FAFSA filing for students who did not receive the opportunity grant. One of the questions the committee had would be, was, well, why, if you'd not received the opportunity grant, would you file the FAFSA in subsequent years? The biggest reason for that was part of what you heard yesterday, and that is that almost all of the students who received the opportunity grant are also receiving the federal Pell Grant. And the federal Pell Grant for many of these students is $4,000 a year, and it is not a there is no cutoff date with the federal Pell Grant. So it's an entry at any time during the year in that process. So these students, whether they received or didn't receive an opportunity grant, would still have a high level of motivation to still do the filing for the FAFSA, which is what we're drawing this information from. As you can see, each year there is a wide gap in it between the upper line and the lower line in terms of that subsequent FAFSA filing. So we go out to these later years, we don't have yet subsequent information about that, so that's where we're having fewer data points in which to do those comparisons. But still, a tremendous difference in what we see as a key indicator about this student's persistence in pursuing their post-secondary education. This chart is for students at the state's public four-year institutions. This next chart compares the same data for students who are enrolling at community colleges. And again, the performance rate, there is not as much persistence, but again, students who are going to a community college usually are only enrolling for 2 or 3 years. And then if they're continuing their education or switching to a four-year institution. So you would expect to see after the second year a rapid fall off as students make other choices about their educational needs. But again, it's a substantial difference each year between those students who received the opportunity grant and those that did not. If there are no questions on these particular charts, I'll move on to the updated information about race and ethnicity. Again, the committee had questions about whether the information that we supplied, which was just a single year, again, that same 98-99 information, about whether we saw any changes by year in this particular progression. And this is for students at the state public universities. And I think we see steady progress in most categories for students of different races and ethnicities over time, although we certainly see some drop-off in the year 2002-03 for students of color. But, you know, this is an area where, and these are, again, opportunity grant recipients. It may have been just the economic situation that caused many of those families to feel that they didn't have as broad a way in which to be able to afford what was happening in terms of cost of attendance at those institutions. We do see some strengthening in those numbers here in the 03 or 04 year, which is the last year for which we have records. One of the things I'd like to have the committee note in this chart is that the highest group in this is students who are Asian and Pacific Islander. When we compare this to the next chart, the community college opportunity grant recipient, we see a considerable difference, a much lower percentage of Asian Pacific Islanders choosing to go to community colleges as compared to the other races. When I looked at these numbers at first, I thought, oh my gosh, I mean, we have much higher Hispanic participation here, but the scales are slightly different on the charts. The Hispanic participation is strong and growing in both charts at about the same percentage rate. So I think that is a good indicator in terms of students being able to access the opportunity grant to use it to attend the school of their choice. You know, this is an area that, as we move on talking about what folks would like us to look at for performance measures for the coming biennium, that we have to use some caution. We cannot make awarding decisions based on a person's race and ethnicity, and the process is strong when it assures us of colorblindness, because when we get the data, we do not receive any information about the student's race or ethnic background, because it's coming off of the FAFSA form, and it does not collect any data on the FAFSA related to this. So for us to be able to bring this information to you, we had to go back to the institutions and have them report to us what students had reported to their parent institution where they're attending school. So what we can do in order to encourage greater participation by students of color is to extend our outreach efforts, making sure that programs like Aspire and college fairs and those sorts of things are reaching students of all demographics across our state in a way that they can understand and help them make good decisions about their futures. If there's no question about these charts, we'll move on to perhaps at this point we want to speak about the chart that Steve passed out. I think yours are in color.
I'm sorry. Yes. I think we'd have to go back. I'm impressed with the number of Native Americans in community college enrollment. Do you see that as a good sign? And is that because that's probably their enrollment's probably higher, because we don't have your percentage of population overall, but it appears to be really good, especially for the community colleges.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, yes, I think this is something that says the entire system needs to be commended for its outreach efforts. This is not something that the Student Assistance Commission does on its own. This is really in conjunction with all of the things that are happening in the recruitment and admissions offices on college campuses all across our state. The financial assistance is an important component, but clearly not the only component that helps a student decide what they're going to do once they complete high school.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Just to make sure I get it right in my head here, though, this represents the opportunity grant recipients and their percentage. I think what it also reflects, or maybe more accurately reflects, those people in need. Still, we have a pretty high percentage of people in the ethnic, racial and ethnic minority categories who are at the lower end of the economic scale, and those are the ones that are in that are also in need.
Mr. Chairman, Representative March, yes, that's certainly true. This data is about students attending those institutions who are receiving the opportunity grant. And, you know, perhaps we would wish that our population as a whole, no matter what your race or color or background, had less of a need for our assistance. But if that need does exist, we want to make sure that students are being able to readily access that level of support. I think all of us in post-secondary education feel very strongly that financial criteria shouldn't be a reason why a student wouldn't be able to go to school.
Thank you for the opportunity.
So if we could first draw your attention to the chart that Steve distributed, the agency received some instruction from Ways and Means in the 2003 legislative session asking us to focus some attention on revising our performance measures. So Some of the things that the co-chairs had asked us to look at were things that we had been asked to consider in the 2003 session. Because of all of the turbulence in the program, we came to that task rather late in the biennium, but have been very earnest in getting it done during this legislative session. And I think most of the things that are being proposed are ones that are doable for us, but I think it's important that we consider carefully how we would do them. Some of them will cause an added cost for us. So what we've done is, in this display here that's up on the screen right now, we actually take each of the measures, both present and proposed, and have laid those out so that you can see the so we can have a discussion about those. In the past, we measured the percentage of eligible students who are awarded an opportunity grant, and I think all of us acknowledge that that's really not a measure of what happens at the Student Assistance Commission unless we did some things that were rather what most people would deem to be not good decisions. And that, I mean, we could water down the grants and give everybody a very minimal grant, and we could say we awarded everybody, but that wouldn't really help students be able to achieve their educational goals. So that's really not a good direction for the commission to go. And it really has more to do with what are the resources available to the legislature and the commission in carrying that out. So we would propose to delete that particular performance measure.
And replace it with?
And replace it with this information about persistence and completion. The data that we've just shown you is the information that we're using to measure persistence, that repeat filing for financial aid assistance each year. But in addition to that, we had shown the committee earlier on some data that we got from a national database where we showed degree completion for recipients versus non-recipients. In order for us to gather that information, we have to go to a national data service to get that, and it costs us 25 cents for each record that we request a match for. The data that we shared with you in phase one was just a sample in each of the three sectors, the independents, the community colleges, and the OUS system. And we would propose in the future that instead of having to go to that national database, to instead request that the institutions, that we would modify our agreement with each of the institutions that we provide opportunity grant funding to have them report back to us the race, ethnicity, and the degree completion information so that it would not be an added cost to the Student Assistance Commission to gather that information, but rather part of our partnership with the schools we work with. I probably need to be more methodical as I work my way down the list here. The next measure is also one we would propose to delete that had been used in the past. This is the need-based grant dollars awarded per FTE student in Oregon for 2 and 4 year institutions. It's not an effective measure on how OSAC's able to deliver services to students, so we would also propose that that one be eliminated. This next one is really an efficiency measure. This is one that the co-chairs have asked us to consider, and this is the percentage growth. In the past, we measured the percentage growth in the number of privately funded scholarships awarded. Instead, we would propose that measure to be a ratio measure, where we're measuring the ratio of administrative dollars to private and public scholarship dollars that are awarded to students. This is really a way for us to gauge how efficient we are in moving those dollars between donors to students and the institutions they attend. And that's also an area where the more donors that we can find to contribute and the more we can manage what our administrative costs are, the more dollars actually reach students in terms of services. We then have several measures which have to do with the student loan program. Items 4 through 7 are all related to that. Those are all measures that are clearly obsolete and we think should be deleted. Measure number 7 here is the time to complete a degree program review. This is an existing measure, and we would propose to continue that one. The last one on this page is customer satisfaction measure. This is one that the work with the Progress Board and other agencies, all agencies are going to be implementing a common customer service measure. This is one where we are working on a plan to implement this. It has not been done except in the Aspire program and in the Office of Degree Authorization in the past. So it's one where we need to extend that into our work with students and with the schools as well for the opportunity grant and the scholarship functions. So this is one where, as we look to setting benchmarks and targets for the coming biennium, we don't really have a history in which to base that. And that's always one of the difficulties in saying, well, where do we think we're going to go? Well, we don't know exactly where we are at today with the new measurement tools that we'll be using. The co-chairs have proposed that we add 2 additional measures for the Office of Degree Authorization. This is on the next page. This is the number of detrimental duplication issues that are resolved by the Office of Degree Authorization. This is one where, because of schools now posting notices to all the other institutions electronically, there have really been many fewer of these types of issues raised. You know, there have only been 2 cases in the last 6 years. So it's not an area where we would expect to see very much activity, which probably has limited utility to all of us then in terms of a measure.
Question from
Actually, it's a comment, and Mr. Chair, and to LFO. I think we've given these numbers 2 in 6 years. This doesn't make for a very good performance measure. It's not. I'd rather see that reported as an exception rather than a performance measure, and maybe we can come up with something that would actually be a performance measure. So that's my comment.
There.
Mr. Contreras, perhaps, would probably be more expert on this particular area.
I'm Alan Contreras, ODA Administrator. Mr. Chair and Representative March, it depends on how you view what it is that ODA ought to be doing in this function. Historically, there were a lot of these cases, and there are all sorts of reasons for that. One of those reasons is lousy communication between the different sectors of post-secondary education. One of the things that my office has tried to do is to improve that, and we have worked with the different sectors with their new email notification systems. Also, we now have an advisory committee for ODA, which was not done before, on which representatives of all of the sectors sit to advise us on rules and things like that. And for that reason, I'm actually inclined to keep some measure on this in there, because I think if you were suddenly to see that there were a dozen adverse impact cases come up in a biennium, that would be an indicator that we had fallen off in our duty to try to keep this process working smoothly. So it depends a little bit on how you want to approach it.
Yeah, so to follow up here, the target is 0, and we're looking for a null case here, basically. And so the target is 0. Is there a positive measure that we could create that would capture something the same along those lines of communication, where we were shooting for 100% and you got 98?
Mr. Chair, Representative March, the only one that comes to mind is that it would be possible to survey the leadership of the principal provider schools in the 3 different sectors regarding their opinion as to whether the process is working well, which would in turn reflect on the operation of our office.
But that would require work. Survey.
It would. But it would get you a number where a high number is better than a low number, if that's where you're trying to go.
Well, doesn't sound like it's going to be a number at all. I mean, if you're shooting for 0, we're going to have 0, I mean, hopefully.
Representative March, it's a situation in which zero is what you want, but I'm not sure how else you can look at it other than simply requiring us to report on it.
Mr. Renner, do you want to weigh in this?
I have a question for the administrator. Would it potentially be possible to do a measure of the number of potential conflicts because of the establishment of a new program that falls under the detrimental duplication statute, and then thereby measure some type of ratio of the number of cases that actually you had to deal with as a ratio of the potential at that same period of time?
Yes, that would be very easy to do. In fact, just last week I obtained the annual numbers of new program announcements from the community college sector, which is where most of them come from. They average 25 new programs per year, including both degree and certificate programs. So it would be possible to generate a complaint ratio, if you will, of cases that came up relative to the number of new programs proposed by public sector institutions. That would be very easy to do. It would just take essentially no staff time.
Mr. Chair, that would be a possibility. Realize again that this would not necessarily, though, be a measure of the performance of the office. It could be viewed as a measure of just how controversial other institutions, notably the private institutions, find the particular course offerings that are being extended by the public institutions. That may be something of interest that you may want to look at, but it really, I don't think, represents a measure of how well ODA is doing its job. Okay,
so Mr. Chair, I agree with what Steve just said. It's a useful piece of information, but it can mean many things.
Thank you.
Please continue.
The next measure is also about the Office of Degree Authorization. And that has to do with the number of degree validation cases resolved by ODA. There are approximately 10 of these each year that we encounter. Some of them are very involved, and some of them are fairly straightforward to deal with. So, again, a fairly low volume measure. But and, you know, it's one of those areas where if we have more, is that a good thing or a bad thing? That would tend to indicate more people trying to use bogus diplomas, which would, I think, cause all of us to be quite concerned. But the fact that somebody's doing something about it would be a good thing. So I'm not sure what we would actually be learning other than something about our general society.
And resolve which way? Positive, negative?
Mr. Chair, this is essentially the rat catcher argument, where if there's lots of them around, that's a bad thing. But if I'm catching lots of them, I'm doing my job correctly. And you have to decide whether you want the number to mean what you want it to mean.
Mr. Bender.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do. I was involved in the discussions when the co-chairs requested, or it was a meeting with the co-chairs and the vice co-chairs, requested addition of these measures. I know that the co-chairs have been interested in looking at outcome measures as much as possible, as opposed to output measures. The output measure, of course, is just a measure of what the agency is doing, and not really taking it to the next step to see how that's affecting the policies that it's designed to implement. I think in this case, in these two cases, the co-chairs wanted to see these measures, realizing that they would just simply be output measures, just to get a better understanding of the office and what it is that it's doing, and have a report of the activities that the office is doing. So that is where I think their requests came from, as sort of an exception to their general request to try to develop more outcome as opposed to output measures.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Okay, Mr. Bender, that seems like a reasonable sort of thing, because there's no way to assess outcome on this issue until you have a baseline from output. not going to know what we're comparing really against, and whether there's been, whether it's been effective or whether we've been ineffective. But we need some kind, it seems to me, a baseline, which is just informational material.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Jensen, I mean, in my prior life, I dealt a lot with performance measures for a significant part of the programs at the Department of Human Services. And there, generally, what we would use was to compare particular, you know, for example, child abuse rates. You know, is it a good thing if we have many complaints or fewer complaints? And it's hard to gauge that. What we tend to do is look at rate per thousand in those circumstances and compare what our rates are compared to other states with similar demographic situations. Again, this is such a small program, and it's not something that is done universally across the country, and so it's hard to have like comparators, although Alan does tell me that we have some counterparts in other parts of the country. So maybe doing that type of comparison to our counterparts in similar sized states might be a way to look at it.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Senator Whitsitt and Representative March.
This might not be the exact place to bring this up, but we're talking about outcomes of programs. I wanted to visit a little about the Jobs Plus scholarship program. And I know you gave me a fair amount of information on that in my office. And just off the top of my head, as I remember, there's been about $9.5 million over the years that's been generated for that program. About $1.5 million has been transferred to OZAC. And of that, about $750,000 was actually applied to the scholarship for Jobs Plus individuals, which leaves a lot of money on the table. And it would appear that in 2003-2005, the legislature picked up about $675,000 of that for the general fund, and another $2.1 million went to DHS for administrative services. And then again, in this biennium, the governor's budget would put another, as I recall, about $2.6 million more to Department of Human Services Administration. And that seems to be a clearly broken process, in that unless we believe that no one really wants that money, and I don't believe that, then how do we, I guess my question to you is, how do you plan to address that issue? Is that a performance measure, or is that on the table? And how will you take those monies that is being set aside for those students and for that improvement in their family education and actually see that they get it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Whitsitt, the questions that came from the committee during phase one motivated me to spend a lot of time doing research during the interim weeks between then and now on this particular issue. Then the numbers that you cite are correct in terms of what has been happening with funds that initially came from employers to the state to be used for the establishment of those individual education accounts. Unfortunately, because of difficulties in the paperwork transition process, only about a third of those funds actually are received by the Student Assistance Commission. When the client fails to file a document with the Department of Human Services saying they want to activate the account, that means the DHS holds those funds until the client actually processes that piece of paper. There are a number of notices that DHS sends out to the clients about the client's need to initiate, but the client has not yet finished the paperwork. One of the things I've been talking with the Department of Human Services about, and again, because of my past knowledge of how they can use databases in order to discern a lot of things about what's happening with their clients, is to do some database matches where we can find out, have those clients actually held employment for the equivalent of what would be 30 days, because that's one of the requirements in statute, is that a client to work 30 days in an unsubsidized job. So to do that record match with the employment department's records to discern the employment history for the client after they've left the program, and to use that as a way in which to perhaps initiate the transfer of the funds in the future to the Student Assistance Commission. And we also want to work very closely with the Department of Human Services to do more outreach to these clients so that they understand that it's not just the Jobs Plus money that they have in their individual education account that they can use to pursue additional education, but also that the Pell Grant is a resource that many of them will be eligible for, and to work very closely with local jobs program managers and with community colleges in our communities that are closest to these clients so that they can better use the resources that they've worked hard to earn. And that's really the Student Assistance Commission's perspective about this program, is that these are benefits that have been earned by these clients, and we need to be very active in our efforts to help them maximize the return on that endeavor. Unfortunately, in the governor's budget, the Department of Human Services has a number of challenges. And as a part of their way in which to mitigate part of those challenges, they had continued the expectation that they would be using expired funds to that extent of the $2.6 million that you quoted to help pay for many of the other holes that exist in their service delivery system because of the resource constraints. But my counterpart, Marge Reinhart at DHS, is very committed to working with this. And also there's, I guess, another piece of legislation that's out there called Parents as Scholars, which is really to encourage DHS TANF beneficiaries to be able to pursue education to manage to escape the poverty situation they find themselves in. So DHS is taking a different look.
Yes, Senator Whitson.
Just as a follow-up, do you believe this is a failure of process, or do you think it's a failure of will, or do you think that the fact that the money is being utilized in another fashion from what it was being collected for is the driving force behind this program not working as it was designed?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I don't really know what the motive or perhaps lack of motive is in order to have the clients fulfill what people hoped would be the potential of this program. I don't have enough experience with the program and with the people who are the participants in it in order to be able to say. All I can speak to is the very honest commitments that I've heard from DHS and from the staff that I work with at OSAP to work very hard to improve our success rate in this program. Unfortunately, the statute is somewhat awkwardly designed where, by its design, both agencies could have had some statutory motivation not to use the funds. The Student Assistance Commission does not receive any administrative funds to operate the program except for the interest earnings on the principal that sits in the accounts. So the less principal that is used for student benefits, the more interest that comes to the agency. It's a grand $16,000 a biennium, so we're not getting rich off of it by any means. But it is a rather perverse construction to the statute. And DHS doesn't really have anything that requires them to transfer the funds if the client doesn't complete the paperwork. Mm-hmm. The statute is rather silent on what's to happen with the funds when the client doesn't complete that paperwork transaction.
And one follow-up,
yes.
Then essentially the DHS is utilizing those funds for their own purposes in addition to the interest that's accrued on those funds while they hold them. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I mean, for their own purposes in serving, again, very needy clients. DHS is certainly not...
For the administrative services, to pay for the administrative processes.
What they're using the funds for, as I understand, are jobs-related services to clients. So it's still staying within the same client group, but not for educational services for those clients.
Clearly not for what the money was collected for.
I believe not.
Thank you.
Ms. Lowe, we will have to conclude here in the next couple of minutes. Sorry I had to step out to provide some testimony in another committee. My basic gist from the testimony I heard at the beginning and at the end is that I think the performance measures are getting better, but there's still a little bit more work that needs to be done. So if you will work with Mr. Bender and me and whoever my I think my new counterpart is going to be Representative Morgan on the House side, we'll try to get this resolved before you come back for a work session. So if you would like to close at this point, that would be very beneficial. And
Mr. Chair, I would just like to thank the committee for all of their attention and commitment to the functions that the staff at OSAC are, like, committed to. I think we've had a very healthy and energetic dialogue about the opportunity that's within the Student Assistance Commission, and I appreciate all of your questions and concerns. They make our program stronger, so thank you for all of your consideration.
Thank you very much. And with that, I will close this hearing, and I'll close the committee, and hopefully sometime before this session is over, we will be back together.
Together again?